All right, good morning, everybody. It is Wednesday, November 17th, 11:17 now. And we're doing Chem 12B, lecture component. So we have a few more people that were waiting to jump in here. I was going to mention this morning that as my life is returning back to normal and I'm sort of spending more time at home here and less time up in the Bay Area, I am managing to get more things done. And as you noticed the other day, I got the exams uploaded into the Canvas shell, everything's created. And there was some concern that I wanted to talk about people looking at those exams and trying to figure out what options they have. The exams actually weren't so bad. They were actually pretty good. But what I also have is I have exam corrections that I offer for the exams. And the way that works is I have them programmed into the Canvas shell. Let me see if I can show you where that is and how that works. If I'm still logged in here into the Canvas shell, and I'll share the screen. Hang on 1 second. Yeah. Oh, come on, mouse. My mouse keeps dropping off. Losing connection. There we go. Screen share. Desktop 3, Safari, Firefox. Okay, so here is the Canvas shell and the exam one, and then the exam corrections are also published here. So under exam corrections, rework the problems that you got wrong on the exam. You only need to resubmit the problems that you are correcting. And I have the original work and all the comments, so I only need the corrections. I don't need all the pages. I only need the parts that you are correcting. And I'll change the date. I have this due April 18th. I didn't fix that. Look at a calendar. I'll put in a new due date for that. That's going to put us right up close to finals week. We'll just say that it's due by the end of class, by the end of the semester. But sooner rather than later would be better. And I'll save that. And that puts a due date of like the 6th. And I'll leave that there and save it. Come on. All right. So it has the same sort of upload instructions that the exam had, where you will take and you'll just upload the corrections that you've done. And then the other big concern there was how many points people can earn back on doing those exam corrections. And it's sort of a floating scale. So if you had a difficult time on the exam and your scores on the exam were in the 50s, then what I allow you to do is to go back and do all the corrections, and I get you back up into a passing grade, into a middle B in a 75 sort of position. If you were somebody who wound up getting a grade that was in the 70s, I allow you to move up essentially one grade. So if you wound up getting like a 75, then you could wind up getting an 85 out of the exam. If you got something like an 85 on the exam, you could wind up turning that into a 95. If you got somewhere in the 90s, it's going to be a point or two that I'm going to throw back at you. And so by the time you get up into the 90s, it may not entirely be worth it to go through and do the exam corrections, but the exam corrections are open to everybody and you can go through and do that. And if you need support on those exam corrections, I make sure you look at your exam and the file that I uploaded that had the corrections or had the comments in it. I gave quite a few comments in the different areas as to what was wrong, but not necessarily how to correct it. But I did go through, particularly for the synthesis problems, and give a lot of hints within the synthesis problems, oftentimes showing you where a disconnection was a bad disconnection and what a better disconnection may be to take it forward and move it forward, or problems with reactions that were not giving selectivity for the position that you were trying to target. So there was a lot of different comments that I gave depending upon the different types of problems. But if you need more help than that, then I would say just jump into office hours and I'll try to give you more direction and try to point you in the right direction on those exam corrections. So those are open to everybody and due at the end of the semester, by the end of the semester. Okay. So if there's any questions in that, I'm happy to answer questions. Like I said, office hours are always open for dealing with those as well. And I'm happy to give more direction there. Okay, so let me go ahead and jump back into the screen share. And there's a couple of...
Hey, Jason?
Yeah.
Really quick before we go on, did you mention anything about the NMR quiz and if whether or not that's due now or?
Yes, I did not say when it's due, but that should be, I should have had that due already. Let's put a due date of, what's today? Let's put a due date of Monday on that. Just since I didn't have one. I'll go back in and fix that. But that should be due on Monday.
Cool, thanks.
Okay. Oh, new. Okay. So we've done quite a bit of work on mass spec. And despite my epic failure earlier this morning on that last problem that I was working on, that was a blow to my ego. That happens with mass spec periodically on similar types of compounds. Being able to distinguish very similar compounds is oftentimes quite difficult in mass spec, which is why those quizzes are really helpful and the tips that they give in those quizzes are helpful. But I want to go through a few more ideas in mass spec. Things to look for. I want to hit isotope effects. I want to hit what to look for functional groups. This morning, we already did a pretty good exercise on looking at calculating the number of carbons and also using oxygen isotopes. So that's a component as well. And then the last part that I want to look at are some heterolytic fragmentations. And then it's really down to examples and just dealing with a bunch of examples. So this isotope effect that I want to look at, with the isotope effects, there's really one other thing that we tend to look for, and that's halogens. The different halogen isotopes, fluorine 19, chlorine, which is 35, and there is a chlorine, which is 37. There is a bromine, which is 79, and a bromine, which is 81. And then there is an iodine, and iodine is, I always forget it. 127. So the fluorine only has one isotope. It's 100% F19. And iodine, while there are different isotopes of iodine, there's only one which is naturally occurring, iodine-127. The other ones are radioactive and not long-lived and not found in nature normally. But chlorine-35 and chlorine-37 and bromine-79 and bromine-81 are all naturally occurring isotopes. And so when we look at those, chlorine-35 is 75% and chlorine-37 is 25%. And just rounding out the numbers just to make it easy, bromine-79 and bromine-81 are close to 50-50. It's like 49-51 in favor of the 35, but they're really in favor of the 79. They're really close. And so what that means is when a molecule has halogens in it, you can generally tell the type of halogen from the spectrum. So one of the things that we see when a molecule has chlorine in it Let's do C4 with a chlorine. What we wind up getting, and so the formula is going to be C4H, it's saturated, so that would be 10, but we're going to have 9Cl. What we wind up getting is two molecules for the molecular ion. So the molecular ion peak would normally be 4 times 12 plus 9 plus 35, 92. But you're going to wind up getting two molecular ion peaks. You're going to wind up getting C4H9Cl where it's 35, and you're going to get C4H9Cl where it's 37. And so this one is going to be 92, but this one is going to be 94. And they're going to be in ratios relative to their relative abundance, 75 to 25. So you're going to see 75% and 25%. And so the spectrum is going to look like this. You're going to have your molecular ion peak, which is going to be out here at 92. And then a peak which is about one third that height, which is going to be at 94. And they come in a 3-to-1 ratio. Two units apart. So that 3-to-1 ratio, two units apart, oftentimes signifies that the molecule has a chlorine in it. So when we recognize that this is the molecular ion peak, they're actually technically both molecular ion peaks. It's that this is the molecular ion with a chlorine 35, and this is a molecular ion with a chlorine 37. And so that 3-to-1 ratio, two units apart, oftentimes tells us that there's a chlorine. And what we can oftentimes see too is that we will see that propagated throughout the spectrum, we'll oftentimes see it more than once within the spectrum. And so we'll see these guys 2 units apart, 3-to-1 ratio. And that duplication of that in the fragmentation pattern. So these would be fragments where we would be losing carbon components, but still having the chlorine in there. And this would undergo the same fragmentation process. And that allows us to recognize that the molecule likely has a chlorine. If it's a fluorine or an iodine, then you don't recognize it because there's only the one isotope of fluorine and the one isotope of iodine. And so that doesn't help us. But with chlorine and bromine, we can tell the difference. And bromine in particular, if we have the same sort of formula that has a bromine in it, then what we get is C4H9Br. Molecular ion peak now is equal to 79 plus 48 plus 9, 136. And what we get is a C4H9Br, which is 79, and a C4H9Br, which is 81. And so we get 136 and we get 138, but now they are 50% and 50%. And so the spectrum would have peaks that are 2 units apart and very close in height, 136, 138. And they are in a 1-to-1 ratio, 2 units apart. And we typically see those 2 units apart, 1-to-1 ratio throughout the spectrum in different places as the molecule fragments. It does so to retain the bromine oftentimes. And so what's happening is the fragmentation pattern is this guy to each of those, and this guy here to each of those. And so the presence of that 50-50 oftentimes can tell us that the molecule has a bromine in it. So when we go back to the website here, and we go to halides, they're showing us a typical halide spectrum here that's got 124 and 124, and then the 79 and 81, and how they're doubling up 2 units apart in a 50-50 sort of idea. If we go and we look at the halogen quiz, we can take a look at the spectrum and we can say, what halogen does this molecule likely have? The molecular ion peak is 50, and then there's a 52 peak, and they're in a 3-to-1 ratio. So in a 3-to-1 ratio, what halogen is that likely that this contains? The 3-to-1 ratio is the chlorine. And so this molecule, whatever this molecule is, it's likely to be chlorine. Come on, mouse. Okay, if we back it up and we go and look at another one, we can ask, what sort of halogen does this molecule likely contain? This one, the molecular ion peak is 122 and 124. at 122 and 124, that's likely to be a bromine at a 50-50. And so we see the doubling of the peak at the molecular ion peak in ratios that are sort of equivalent ratios. Here's another one, 84 and 86 and 88. And that's an interesting pattern. That's not a 3-to-1 pattern. That's a slightly different pattern. But it's also not a 50-50 pattern. Let me see if I can show you another tool. Let me stop this screen share and share desktop too. And let's get rid of the periodic table for a minute. We'll get rid of these isotopes and my calendar and music we don't need. Mass calculator. Let me do a small molecule, what we were talking about before, C4H9Cl. And let me turn down, that's just not going to function, so I'll use this one. Let me turn down this guy. Here, what we can see is this is the molecular ion peak, and then this is the 2 units apart peak that is right here. So that peak is the 2 units apart peak that is 1/3 the height of this peak, which is the molecular ion peak. When there is one chlorine in there, we expect the 3-to-1 ratio. If I take and swap that out, instead of a chlorine and I put in a bromine, then what we get is we get the 50-50. And you can see the 50-50 there and how that comes together. Looks like I need a new mouse. The batteries just won't hold in place, so the batteries keep disconnecting. All right, but what happens if I go back to the chlorine in the 3-to-1 ratio and I put in 2 chlorines? Can you imagine what's gonna happen when I put in 2 chlorines? Maybe before I even do it, maybe what I do is let's do this on paper before I even do it to show what happens with 2 chlorines. So if I take a molecule and I put 2 chlorines in the molecule, formula is C4H10Cl2. Each one of those chlorines have different probabilities associated with their ability to be a chlorine-37. Or chlorine 35. And so what happens is if I take that molecule and I'm going to copy it and throw it in a couple of times, there is one possibility where each of the chlorines is chlorine 35. One of them can be 35 and the other one 37, but it could also be the other way around, 37 and 35. And then there's also a possibility where they're both 37. Now, the natural isotopic distribution is that chlorine 35 is 75%. And chlorine 37 is 25%. So basically what winds up happening is this is the most likely scenario. And math-wise, I'd have to calculate out what its percentage height would be. But basically, what's going to happen is this is going to be the tallest peak. This peak here is going to be the next most likely because I have two ways to be able to get that. And then this one is going to be really tiny in the way that they're going to add up. And they are each going to be 2 units apart. And so I get this adding up of lines, 2 units apart, in the probability of these guys coming together. So let me take you back to the other screen real quick. And let me change this to the C8, CL2. And show what that's going to look like. C8, CL2. And there you can see the succession of lines that I have the molecular ion peak. This one where I have one that is 35 and one that is 37. And then where they're both where they're both 37. And that's this peak here. And so when I've got two chlorines in the mix, I'll wind up getting these peaks that are 2 units apart stacked in this sort of way. What happens if they're both bromines? Remember, bromine is 50-50. So if I change this to bromine, then, it's supposed to be bromine two. Then what I get is I get almost that triplet pattern. I get a very tall center peak. It is less likely that I'll get two that are bromine 79. It is less likely that I'll get two that are bromine 81. It is much more likely, because they're 50-50, that I will get one that's 87 and one that's 79 and one that's 81. And there's two different ways that I can get that. And so I almost get a triplet pattern 2 units apart. So it doesn't happen very often that I get two halogens. It doesn't happen very often that I get two bromines or two chlorines. But just so that we kind of know what happens, what's really important is understanding that idea that halogens, chlorines in particular, show up in a 3-to-1 ratio when there's only one chlorine. And so there's our 3-to-1 ratio. And that when there is one bromine, they show up in a 1-to-1 ratio. And that's the important part to watch for. So that's our halogen sort of idea, halogen isotope idea there. That's the main isotope effect that I wanted to look at. And then let's take a review and look at some of these different functional groups and go through Linda Breachy's website real quick and show what we're looking for there in different functional groups. So what I like about this is that this tutorial component has just a really quick overview of what to look for each of the functional groups. And as we were showing this morning, they're showing the cleavages on the right-hand side using that vertical and horizontal red line and where the horizontal component is, that is the observable, and they put the mass of the observable. They also put the MZ ratio of the molecular ion peak down there. So where they write MZ equals 88 for the alcohol, that's the one that they're observing, the 3-pentanol. And they give you a sort of brief overview of what different functional groups do. Alcohols. An alcohol molecular ion is small or non-existent. Cleavage of the carbon-carbon bond next to the oxygen usually occurs. A loss of water may occur, as in the spectrum below. So remember how this morning we were saying that all molecules are even molecular weight unless they contain nitrogen? And we showed why that was true. And yet, this alcohol spectrum is showing a 59 as an odd number. And that's not its molecular ion. Its molecular ion would be at 88.15 or 88, and there is no 88 on the spectrum. Why isn't there an 88 on the spectrum? Because the proton falls off of alcohol so quickly that the molecular ion sometimes doesn't show up. Which leaves you asking, well, then how do I deal with an alcohol? What do I do with an alcohol then? How do I know that it's the molecular ion? And the answer is other types of spectroscopy are going to help you. That we can look in the IR for an alcohol. We can look for an exchanges in the proton NMR for an alcohol. And then we can reconcile that with the mass spec and say that this thing is likely an alcohol and that the molecular ion peak may not be showing up. So all the pieces of data have to kind of work together. That loss of water, though, is very characteristic for alcohols. And so that happens quite frequently. Aldehydes, cleavage of bonds next to the carbonyl results in the loss of hydrogen, molecular ion less 1, or the loss of CHO, molecular ion less 29. These guys also do the alpha cleavages. And so we typically see the alpha cleavage with aldehydes on either side of the carbonyl, loss of 1 on one side, loss of the CHO on the other side. Alkanes, this is where we talked about what we called an alkyl ion series or an alkyl loss series. The molecular ion peaks are present, possibly with low intensity, but the fragmentation pattern contains clusters of mass of 14 where each CH2 group gets chunked off. And so you can see that series in here highlighted in red, 15, 29, 43, 57. That's what's called the alkyl ion series. Amides and carbonyls like amides, when they're long enough, like to undergo what's called the McLafferty rearrangement. And we showed that McLafferty cleavage on the first day when we did this. We'll go back and we'll do some problems that actually have McLafferty in it. And so those amides and longer carbonyl compounds will oftentimes do the McLafferty. There's something else about this that's unique. Not that one that I'm clicking there, but the one that's up above. The molecular ion in this is 101, which is an odd mass. And the odd mass usually indicates the presence of a nitrogen within the molecule. So when the molecular ion is an odd weight, it usually means that there's a nitrogen that's included. Same is true for the amine. Molecular ion peak is an odd number. Alpha cleavage dominates aliphatic amines. And so they undergo alpha cleavage as well. We'll have to look at how to go through and do those alpha cleavages from the amines. Aromatics are really cool in that the molecular ion peak is usually also the base peak. So when you have a really stable aromatic molecule, they don't tend to fragment very much. And so the base peak and the molecular ion peak are one in the same. So when you have a molecular ion peak that has a percent abundance that is 100%, that usually indicates that your molecule is aromatic. So it gives you some hints there. Carboxylic acids, these tend to lose OH and then a carbon monoxide. So they have a loss of 17 and then a loss of 28 as they fragment. Or you look at that 28 and 17, you get that loss of 45 from carboxylic acids. Esters undergo McLafferty, but they also undergo the alpha cleavages. And so you can see that they're doing alpha cleavages in both directions on the esters. Ethers are alpha cleavages. And halides, we just went through, which are the isotope effects looking for the 3-to-1 ratio or the 1-to-1 ratio. And then we tend not to give you fluorides or iodides. And fluorides and iodides just aren't as common as bromides and chlorides anyway. So we're typically looking for the bromides and the chlorides. And then ketones, alpha cleavages. And so that's sort of an overview of the different types of functional groups. And so sometimes we can get functional group information out of it by looking at the molecule. But oftentimes we're not trying to work just from the mass spec. We're trying to work from the mass spec, the NMR, and the IR, and putting them all together. So let me see where I want to go. Next with these, I had a series of problems to look at. But before we do, I think I want to hit that heterolytic alpha fragmentation. So what we had looked at was the homolytic, and I'll work from the carbonyl X and Y, just to refresh your memory on this guy. When we look at the homolytic, we cleave the bond, we take the electrons and we push the electrons in and out. And it's a free radical mechanism, so we're using the fishhook arrows. This gives us one half of the molecule connected to the oxygen, and it gives us the radical other part. This part is considered the loss, and this part the observable. So when I look at that, the way that I note that is this is my loss and this is my observable. And I can do that on either side. So I can get the loss over here, or I could get this observable, where that piece is the charged fragment. That's homolytic. These bonds can also fragment heterolytically. And it's good to know how to do both. So here, it all looks the same, except it works from a resonance contributor. here what winds up happening is the bond splits, but it splits taking the two electrons with it. So we work from the resonance contributor. And as this fragments, it generates the carbonyl. It generates a free radical on the carbon, and X has lost its electrons. This makes the left-hand part the loss because it's neutral, and it makes the X the observable. Because that part is charged. What this means is that if you're looking at this, this thing can cleave in two ways. It can cleave homolytically, such that X is the loss and the carbonyl portion is the observable, or it can cleave such that X is the detectable, the observable part, and the carbonyl becomes the loss. And it's homolytic versus heterolytic, which means that for every carbonyl, there are four possibilities, two that are homolytic and two that are heterolytic. So for every carbonyl, there are four possibilities. There are two that are homo and two that are heterolytic. And so if I take a carbonyl and I look at X and Y, what I can do is I can say, all right, this cleavage here, where I take the carbonyl, this is the homolytic alpha, and that would be the observable part that I would see there. But there's another cleavage where I could see this part, and this is the heterolytic. And the same is true for the other side. That I could cleave this piece. This is the other homolytic. And this piece would be the heterolytic. And how many of these you will observe depends upon the stability of the fragment that is formed. You may observe one. Two, three, or all four. Which means that just by looking for all four and saying, hey, all four aren't there in the spectrum, doesn't mean that that's not the spectrum. Because it's really about the stability of the fragments that are formed and how stable those fragments are as to whether or not we would see those fragments. And so we look for them, but just because they're not there doesn't discount a particular spectrum. doesn't tell us that the spectrum isn't there. All right, let's take and let's do a couple of examples of starting to put all kinds of things together. So I'm going to set up some spectrum here. I'm going to stop the screen share for a minute. And I'm going to go and grab some spectrum that I want us to use. So give me a second while I get here. I'm going to grab a spectrum off of organic structure elucidation. But what I don't want is I don't want you to see the formula. And so I'm going to grab these real quick and bring them in. And then I'll rearrange them on the screen so that we can see them, and then we'll do the problem. I do need to rearrange this one. Okay, almost done. One last spectrum to bring in. Oh, this is harder than I thought it was going to be. Not that the problem is hard, but that clipping the spectrum and getting all the spectrum clipped to where I needed them to be to bring them in. Okay, got it. Now I'll share these. My file sent over. Okay, let me go back to screen sharing and show you what I did. Okay, so there should be five files dumped into this thing, all in different places. And that's the carbon NMR. That's the mass spec. And I think I want to start with mass spec. There's the proton. Ooh, and the IR is hiding underneath the proton, so that's kind of helpful. I'll take this one, and then I'll throw that detailing up above it. So there's that piece. And then we've also got the IR that's here. And let me throw that down into a different window. Okay, so this is all one problem. We've got IR. We've got proton NMR. This page we don't need. We've got the mass spec. And we've got the carbon NMR. So we've got everything here in order to do it. And what I like to do is before I start a problem, when I start a problem with all these different types of spectra, is I just like to go through and sort of do an overview of everything. What do you see in the IR? Anybody want to kick in and tell me what seems to be present in the IR? Does anybody see anything relevant?
Is there an alcohol in there?
Alcohol? Looks like it. Looks like it's a little jagged though. It doesn't look smooth like a regular alcohol. Looks kind of jagged. Do you remember what the jaggedness usually implies? When it's not smooth?
Was that when the alcohol was connected to something else?
Typically, kind of. It usually implies carboxylic acid. So this is alcohol when it's smooth and connected to something else, meaning that it dimerizes. This is jagged. And so this is sort of that jagged pattern that we're seeing here that would sort of imply carboxylic acid. And also, this 1700 is carbonyl, which would also be in there for carboxylic acid. I would expect a carbonyl if it were carboxylic acid, because it would have both functional groups. All right, so maybe carboxylic acid. Is there anything in the proton NMR that jumps out at you? What about that guy that's all the way down there, like around 10, very broad exchanges? That is also pointing at carboxylic acid. Anything in the mass spec that jumps out at you? So I'm looking for glaring things. I'm not like digging right now. I'm not calculating any numbers. I'm not doing anything fancy. I'm just looking for things that are jumping out at me and saying, hey, you should pay attention to me. This is the base peak. This is the molecular ion peak, of which you say, hey, wait a minute, there's two molecular ion peaks. There are, one's at 152 and one's at 154. And they look like they're in a one-to-one ratio. Not only is that at a one-to-one ratio, but so is that, and so is that. So what is this mass spec trying to scream at you?
Does it have to do with the presence of a bromine?
Yeah, this thing is screaming bromine. All right, and then we can look at the carbon NMR. And the carbon NMR has some interesting information in it. Usually we don't get splittings in the carbon NMR, but this carbon NMR is giving us splitting information. It's telling us that this signal is a triplet, and a singlet. This 178, well, that's our carbonyl. And likely to be the carboxylic acid. These guys that are triplets, these guys are kind of nice because they're telling you that these are CH2 groups because the two protons are splitting its carbon into a triplet. So that's what that little T there is telling you, is it's telling you that that peak is a triplet peak and that is the splitting from the protons. Now, normally we don't get splitting information. Normally the carbon is decoupled, but here they gave you some coupling information, which was kind of nice because they're telling you that these are CH2 groups. So all of this information is just screaming out at you in these, and now it's our job to go and to kind of put it together and to take each one of the pieces of data and to bring the pieces of data together into a single overall picture. So when I do that, the first thing that I'm lacking here. Normally what I would do is I would normally go and get the molecular weight or get the molar molecular formula and then figure out my units of unsaturation. But here I don't have that. So here, the place to really start is to start with the mass spec and the molecular formula. And so here where we're going to start is we're going to say, all right, I have a molecular ion peak that is 152. And I'll start using the 152 rather than the 154, but I'll just be careful. I know that there is a bromine that is in this, and I'll have to use the lower down bromine. If I take the molecular ion that is 154, then I should use a bromine that is 81 in calculating out what my molecular formula is. Now, how do I find the molecular formula? What's my first job here in doing this? They didn't give me the percentages in here for the carbons. So without the percentages for the carbons, I have to fall back on rule of 13. So then we start rule of 13. And our job is to find a formula. So 152 divided by 13. Right? So that's 12. Was that 9? So it looks like I'm dealing with C10 H19, but I also know some other pieces of information to help guide me in figuring out what that formula is. What other pieces of information do I have?
There should be two bromines present.
Why would there be two bromines present?
Is it because of the 50-50 nature? It's 1-to-1.
50-50 is because bromine 79 is 50% and bromine 81 is 50%. So it's not that there's two of them, but that they occur in a 50-50 relative abundance. Chlorine appears in a 3-to-1. So the ratio doesn't tell me exactly how many there are. If I see that 1-to-1 ratio, I know there's only one bromine. If I see the 3-to-1 ratio, I know there's only one chlorine. If there's more than one bromine, then I wind up getting those triplets. And if there's more than one chlorine, then I wind up getting a weird sort of pattern. But let's assume that I only have one. So I know there's at least one bromine, or there is a bromine, but what else do I know is in this molecule from other spectrum that I've reviewed really quickly? So what I know about this spectrum is that mass spec is telling me bromine. IR is telling me carboxylic acid. Not only is the IR telling me that, the HNMR is telling me that, and the CNMR. These three things are telling me carboxylic acid. So that means that my formula of C10H19 needs to be amended to include a bromine and two oxygens before I can get down to my final formula. So what I'll do is I'll just add in the oxygens first, and I will add in an oxygen and take away CH4. And I'll do that twice. So C9H15O, and then C8H11O2, and then I've got to get the bromine in there. So I'm going to add in a bromine, and I'll have to take away. Now, bromine is 79. So I need a carbon-hydrogen equivalent of 79. So just use the rule of 13. right? And so 79 divided by 13 is 6. 6 times 13 is 78. So this is going to be C6H7, which is going to equal 79. So I've got to take away 6 carbons and 7 hydrogens. So taking away 6 carbons would give me C2. Taking away 7 hydrogens, 3, 4, H4, O2Br. So let's just check and make sure that I did everything right. 152 divided by 13 is 11. How did I make that mistake? 11.6. Oh, because it's 22 and I did a zero there and it should have been 11. So my formula should not have been, can I go back and recalculate everything? This is why you check. So it should have been C11, H11 plus 9 would be 20. All right, then I got to redo each one of these. So that's 11 minus 1, and that's going to be 10, and this is going to be H16. That means that this is going to be 9 and 12. And finally, I'm going to be at 6, 9 minus 6 is 3, and H7 from 12 is going to be 5. And then we will check it. 36 plus 5 plus 16, 16 is 32 plus 79 equals 152. That's why we go through and do checks. All right, so 152 is matching 152. Looks like I have a formula that includes all of my components. The two oxygens required for a carboxylic acid and the bromide. And that formula is coming up to the right molar mass. So the next question is, how many units of unsaturation does that have? While you're here, you should complete this. So that's going to be CnH2n plus 2 plus 1 for every nitrogen minus 1 for every halogen. So that's 6, 2 times 6, 2 times 3 is 6 plus 2 is 8. Subtract 1 is 7. So 7 for saturation, I have 5. That's 1 unit unsaturation. And that corresponds, 1 unit of unsaturation fits nicely with my carboxylic acid. Okay, so what we've done so far, and we'll come back and we'll finish this IR part. IR is showing me carboxylic acid at 3067, it's showing me carbonyl, likely to be the carboxylic acid. It's showing me that at 1717. These are both in reciprocal centimeters. Not a whole lot else that I'm going to get out of that IR. That's just the two components that I'm seeing that's in there. The proton NMR, though, we can sit down and we can work on. So how many chemical environments am I seeing in my carbon NMR? Oh, proton NMR. Come online. So we start our table, same as we always would, number of environments. Looks like I've only got three environments. I've got the one that exchanges and then these other two that are at 3 and 3.7. So it looks like I'm at three environments. Fairly quick molecule to put together, parts per million. Integration, multiplicity, number of neighbors. Assignment. So I've got one at 3.0, one that looks at 3.7, and somewhere right around 10. Integrations here are absolute. So it looks like I've got two hydrogens, and one hydrogen. Multiplicities on this first one that are at 3. That's a triplet. The other one's a triplet. So these each have two neighbors. And because those are the only things that are splitting, they have to be splitting each other. These that are integrating for two are CH2 groups. And they must be connected. And this one here, multiplicity singlet exchanges, zero neighbors. That piece, given that it's high parts per million, must be the carboxylic acid. And we should check here and make sure how many protons we've got. 2, 4, 5. This is 5 protons total. And check and see that that matches with my mass spec. 5 H's total. And so that looks like that's working out. The carbon NMR, we've already sort of broken down the carbon NMR. We could put it into a table, but we've already sort of broken it down, and it's showing the two CH2s and it's showing the carboxylic acid. So what I'm seeing here is all said, I have one unit unsaturation. I have a formula, which is C3H5O2Br. From the IR, I'm showing a carboxylic acid. From the proton NMR, I'm showing carboxylic acid and then a connected CH2CH2. Oh, also, I've got that bromine that's in there. From the CNMR, I'm showing the same. And so all of those parts put together with one unit of unsaturation, where the carboxylic acid is one unit of unsaturation, really leads me to a molecule that can't be anything else. The CH2s are connected. There's no methyls. The two terminal groups would be the carboxylic acid and the bromide, and they're connected between them with the two CH2 groups. And there's no other possibilities for explaining this. And it shows how we go through and how we do an entire problem. All right, so we don't have enough time to do another one of these. But what I do want to show you is that that is a tremendous amount of information to go through because there's so many different spectra and so many things to look for. So how do you know what it is that you need to do, and how do you create a checklist so that you check it all off? That I can help you with. Over here, I have a spectroscopy rubric. And the rubric has all the pieces of information all put into one rubric. And this is the rubric I use when I assess these types of problems. So it has the mass spec, and it goes through using the rule of 13, finding the molecular weight, looking for isotope effects, either nitrogen or halogens, decomposition products, finding a few of the decomposition products so that you know what the decomposition products are, getting all of that information, checking off each one of those boxes. Then it goes through the IR, finding the functional groups. Then the proton, chemical environments, spin-spin coupling, integration, assignment. The carbon NMR, chemical environment, assignment. And then there's a final bringing it all together analytical component. Did you calculate the units of unsaturation? Did you propose a number of structures? Did you go through and analyze those structures to figure out your final structure determination? So this rubric is your checklist, and you can sit down there and you can print out this checklist and you can go through the checklist for each one of the structures and making sure that you're checking off every single box. This rubric, more than anything, these problems, people struggled with these problems in going through them and doing them. And when I did the exam, the scores on the exam were good, but I would say that they were around in 78, 80, in that sort of range. What the rubric did is it kicked the scores up into the 90s. For just about everybody, which was super cool. Because now you had a checklist and you knew exactly what you needed to go through and do. And if you look at this, proposed structure analyzed to correctly determine the compound in question. That means getting the right answer. Versus analysis performed on multiple structures, however, minor inconsistencies between spectroscopic data and proposed structures overlooked, leading to an incorrect determination. Getting the wrong answer. Getting the right answer versus getting the wrong answer. On this rubric, which is, I forget how many total points on this rubric. It's like 50 some odd points, 57 points or something on this rubric. The difference between getting the right answer and getting the wrong answer is 0.6 points. I weight process over correct answer. Going through and doing the process will lead you to the right answer more often, but what I'm scoring here is process more than I'm scoring correct answer. So where we were going through some of those problems before and we were struggling, we would get it down to two. And I kept saying, if you can get it down to these two, that's an A. That's nailing it in my book. Because you've gotten it all the way down to being able to now splitting hairs between figuring out what is the right answer. If you can get it down that far, you're in business. And that's what this rubric does. It gives you full credit for breaking down and doing all the assignments and doing all the parts, which is the easier part of it. Assembling it and getting the final right answer is that's that difficult part. But that's where I'm weighting it so heavily on the process rather than getting the right answer. So this is completely doable, even though it may seem like it's an amazing amount of information that you got to do. This is all doable. And we'll go through and we'll do a couple more examples of problems like this. And I've also got a co-op for you guys to do that goes through out there. And I'll get this programmed into Canvas if it's not already, which is FTIR, mass spec, and NMR. And it has you doing several problems that I have here that are on the website so that the formula is not shown. And it's got three different problems in that co-op for you guys to work on. These are three solid problems to go through and to use the rubric and to break it down using the rubric. Okay, so two jobs for you to do. Number one, your job is to get stronger in mass spec. Getting stronger in mass spec means going and working on Linda Breachy's website and practicing some of these quizzes by functional group. I would play with the aldehydes and the ketones and the alcohols and the esters. I would play with those guys that have the carbonyls in them because that's what you're going to see the most. Work on those problems and then hit this cooperative problem that's got these three problems in it. That's what I want you guys working on this weekend. Okay? So you've got solid work to do here. And then don't forget about those exam corrections and hitting me up in office hours if you need help in those exam corrections. And I'll be there to support you on those things, okay? That's it, you got your marching orders.
Right on, thank you.
All right, you guys take care.